Oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Lawrence Hagel presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this court. You may be seated.
Morning, everyone. This morning we have the case of Valerie Smith versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, which is docket number 081667. I understand that we have interns from the Board of Veterans Appeals in court today, and we want to welcome you. And immediately after the argument, the judges will come out, anyone that wants to, and speak with you for a moment or perhaps answer questions that you might have that are not related to the case. I know that you're going to have one of the law clerks talk to you anyway, so we'll spend a short time with you also. Who will speak for the appellant in this case?
Michael Smith, Your Honor.
Mr. Smith, welcome. And who will speak for the secretary?
Your Honor, that would be me, Monique Allen.
Okay, Ms. Allen. You may go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, as I stated, I'm Michael Smith, and I'm here today representing the appellant, Valerie Smith. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal.
Make it so.
My argument today will focus on three main points. First, the board's finding that there was no credible medical evidence of the occurrence of the appellant's brain tumor during her active duty for training is clearly erroneous. Secondly, the board failed to adequately state the reasons and bases for its decision, which included failing to consider the application of the presumption of soundness and issues related to aggravation. And thirdly, the board erred by failing to consider the presumption of service connection for chronic diseases in relation to the appellant's active duty for training service. The first two points I mentioned relate to establishing direct service connection, so I'll start with these. The board erroneously states that there's no competent medical evidence of an etiological relationship between the appellant's brain tumor and her active duty for training, even though there was an opinion from the chief of the VA's neurosurgery department at the VA Medical Center in New York that clearly states that the June and July 1999 headaches were caused by the brain tumor. This is found at page 82 of the record. Now, the board did not find that the neurosurgeon's opinion lacked credibility. As a matter of fact, it relied heavily on that portion of the opinion that stated that the appellant had symptoms some 12 years earlier in the form of headaches, but it ignored the language that established a medical nexus with the appellant's active duty for training service period. It's well established, of course, that the board does not have to accept medical opinions, but if it rejects them, it must state adequately the reasons and bases. Here, there's no discussion or assessment of the weight that the board gave to that portion of the opinion. I believe that the board confused the concepts of etiological connection and manifestation. Etiology relates to the origin or cause of the illness itself. Manifestation relates to the symptomatology and when the problems that manifest the disease occur.
Counsel, was that medical opinion, would you characterize that as clear and convincing? Was the language in that opinion something along the lines of, I believe this might be related, or was it more likely than not?
There was no statement of the degree of certainty. However, there is the statement on the opinion says, I believe the headaches were caused by the tumor, the headaches that occurred within the period of active duty for training service, right. And the word were was underscored in the opinion.
And what in that opinion was that belief based on?
The opinion itself talks about the post-active duty for service treatment that occurred, which occurred within a very short period of time. One can infer that there was he looked at the symptomatology and the close relationship in time between the manifestation and the actual diagnosis, because he does spend a lot of time talking about the subsequent treatment after the diagnosis.
But the opinion does not say what it's based on, does it?
The opinion does not say specifically what it is.
And I think, as I recall, the opinion does it not say that the headaches that the individual was, Ms. Smith was experiencing, was the result of the tumor, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so it doesn't say that it occurred during a particular time frame. In other words, a particular period of active duty. Is that correct?
No, actually it does. It says specifically that the headaches that she experienced during June and July of 1999, which was
correct,
the period we're focusing on, were caused by the tumor.
But it doesn't say that the tumor exists. What it implies or says is that the headaches were the result of the tumor. So the headaches are, in fact, that may be too strong a statement. The headaches then, if I were to follow that opinion correctly, would say, because they don't say when the tumor existed, they do not make the statement about when the cause of these headaches occurred. In other words, it doesn't say that the tumor existed during or was either occurred or was aggravated during a period of active duty. Am I correct in that
statement? Your Honor, I do not know that there is a rational reading of the opinion other than to the medical opinion of that, other than to conclude that he believed the tumor existed during the period of the active duty for training and was causing the headaches.
I understand that it existed. I have no issue with that.
All right.
But the statement, it's the for something to be found to be service-connected, the disability must be incurred in or aggravated by a period of service. And if the tumor, which is the cause of these symptoms, was not incurred in or aggravated by a period of service, then how can it be service-connected? Or how can this opinion say that it's service-connected?
Well, I believe it existed, so therefore it was incurred. It was certainly undiagnosed during the period of active duty for training.
Now, let me ask you one other question, if I can now recall it. Why is it that you believe that, let's put aside the idea of this medical opinion, it seems to me that your initial statement was that the board decision said there is no credible evidence of
etiological relationship
between the headaches and the tumor, and that in fact there is a medical opinion, regardless of how strong it is, that that's actually states that it is, and that your complaint is that the board did not address this single piece of evidence. Indeed, it falsely stated that it didn't exist.
That's absolutely correct.
So, you know, if we're talking about a reasons or basis thing, we don't have to get into the factual conclusions made by the board. That if we believe that was your argument was correct, then we would just order a remand for the board to determine those factual issues. Is that what you're seeking?
Yes.
Okay. Unless there are other questions on this matter, could you go on to your arguments about presumptions?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Let me ask it.
The board erred also by failing to address the presumption of soundness and aggravation, which are raised by the evidence and the board's factual conclusion. A veteran is presumed in sound condition unless noted in an entrance exam otherwise. Here, there is no evidence in her entrance exams that there was any tumor or issues related to her head, other than she did report in a medical history that she had had headaches.
Well, what examinations are we talking about?
Well, that is very interesting, Your Honor. First of all, I will confess that I got into this case after I took it over from an attorney who had retired, so I wasn't there at the record of proceedings level or the record before the agency. So in my files, I'm finding a series of exams, their yearly annual physical exams that were conducted. The latest one I was able to find was 1996, which is about 3 years prior to, I believe, the 99. I think that
And were there periods of active duty subsequent to 96?
Yes, there were.
And what period of active duty are you asserting is the basis for the claim? In other words, during what period of active duty do you claim that the tumor was either occurred or was aggravated?
Well, the June and July active duty for training, which I believe qualifies for active duty.
June or July of what year?
1999.
Okay. Now, how does the 1996, let me ask this question. Do you find any medical exam subsequent to the 1996 medical examination that preceded any of the other periods of active duty?
I do not in my record. There is a reference to the Standard Form 93, which is the report of medical history, which I understand is done at the same time each annual exam is done. And in the VA neurosurgeon's report that we've previously discussed, he mentions a 1998 Standard Form 93, in which he says that in a medical history, the veteran did report headache problems. I haven't been able to locate that myself, but he does reference that. I believe that every year there was an annual physical. I don't think they made it into the record, frankly. I don't think that the annual physical necessarily immediately precedes entry into the active duty for training. I think it possibly occurs on an annual basis without necessarily relating to the exact time the veteran goes in for active duty for training.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't want to monopolize things here. We are talking about applying a presumption, let's say a presumption of aggravation or a presumption of sound condition, in order to apply that presumption, doesn't there have to be an examination as a basis from which aggravation or service connection can be measured?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the burden is on the government to do that. And I have a case which I did not cite in my brief. I'd like permission to cite. If it's a Federal Circuit case.
And when was that case decided?
This case was decided in 1994. It's the Jensen versus Brown, 19 Fed 3rd, 1413. And
Obviously, it's a matter of record, and there is a procedure for identifying this case, and that would, this case occurred before briefing was concluded. Now, let me ask the Secretary if you have any objection to counsel arguing this case now.
May I have a moment, Your Honor?
You may. And we'll not include this in your time.
Thank you.
Certainly, not a problem. I'm sorry, with
supplemental pleading, if necessary?
I'm not inclined to do that right now. I won't make that decision now until I hear the argument. Any objection given that statement?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. You'll certainly have an opportunity to respond, to the argument. Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead.
The argument has been raised recently. The court's ruling on supplementation of the record, and that's why it's being offered so late. But this is just a basic. This is a case by the Fed Circuit that in a veterans case that says that this is based on fundamental fairness that requires the party to bear the burden of proof going forward with the evidence, who's in the best position to produce the evidence. And it states on page 1417, by conducting both induction and separation physical examinations, the government is in the best position to have reliable medical evidence about any changes in pre-existing conditions. If it does not, it cannot penalize the veteran in favor of whom all doubts are to be resolved.
Okay, my position
would be simply that if there is no, it's the government's burden to produce a medical examination with exceptions to it, and in the absence of being able to produce that, the presumption of soundness attaches.
Well, I can understand that if, in fact, the government had a responsibility to conduct a medical examination each time an individual entered active duty for training. Do you know whether or not the government has that responsibility?
All I know is I see in the record annual physical examinations.
Annual is different than immediately prior to entry on active duty, it seems to me.
Well, right. I don't know. I don't know whether they do that at that point.
All right.
But I would state that the way the regs and statutes are written, that the presumption of soundness should apply to any veteran, meaning a person who has previously acquired veteran status. This veteran had acquired veteran status by active duty in 1982. She had already become a veteran for all purposes of the veteran statute. So the way the statutes and regulations are written, the presumption of soundness should apply. Now, moving quickly.
Counselor, let me jump in here. So it is your contention that once someone has attained the status of veteran, you have a presumption of soundness, and 10, 20 years elapse, active duty for training possibly, or possibly reenlistment at a later time. You're suggesting that that interim period when an individual is not on active duty is somehow covered by this presumption of soundness. Is that your position?
The entry into the active duty for training would be.
But 38 U.S.C. 1112, doesn't that require that somehow during this active duty for training period, the injury or the disease manifest itself during that period of time?
Well, Your Honor, that of course relates to the presumption relating to chronic diseases. We were talking about the presumption of soundness, but they do get intermingled, although the considerations are different. But yes, the presumption of chronic diseases, it must manifest within a specific time after the period of service has ended.
Active duty.
Well, that's not the way I read the statute. Active duty is not used in the regulations. The word active duty is not. It says period of service.
Well, I think Judge Lance's question, as I undertook him, was with regard to the statute. Now, do you have the statute in front of you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, now, what does the statute say?
The statute says a chronic disease becoming manifest within 1 year from the date of separation from such service.
And what does such service refer to?
Well, I believe it to be the active military service.
Okay. So now looking back, as I read 112, the presumption of service connection, as I see that, the requirements are that the individual be a veteran, and let's say for purposes of argument that the individual is a veteran. Certainly the individual is a veteran. There's no question that they're a veteran, whether a veteran within the meaning of the statute, that I'm sure will be argued. And then the next element is that they served on active duty or active naval, military, or air service. Correct? I mean, that's the language in the statute.
Yes, sir.
Now, if you go to the definition of active naval, military, or air service, which is in 3.6 and then a subsection of that, it says that active duty for training is considered active naval, military, or air service if the individual is disabled from a disease in the line of duty during that period. Okay, so it seems to me that unless you can show that the disability, i.e. the tumor, occurred during the period of inactive duty for service, it doesn't fit under the statute within the definition of naval, military, and air service that would provide the presumption of service connection. Now, did you follow that?
Because
it took me a long time to put that together when I was trying to review this case.
I did follow that. I would just cite, I think that, first of all, the CFR section 3.307, contemplates subsequent periods of service, and it doesn't contemplate active duty. It doesn't say that, and I believe that the government, in this case, I would argue that their interpretation of the statute should be followed. Secondly, though, with going back to the neurosurgeon's etiology opinion, we do have the incurrence of a disability during active duty for training, which qualifies this veteran under 24B for active military service. So the presumption of soundness attaches by virtue of that.
Okay.
Counselor, in the record, is there an opinion dealing with the headaches going back to 1987, as I recall?
That is correct.
Is that different than the one you're alluding to?
Yes, there is a private opinion. The VA neurosurgeon does mention that the headaches were mentioned years earlier. I think it was 87 or so. And then there's a private opinion that says that these are slow-growing tumors and could have been there a long time. That's what it says. And my position on that is simply if it manifests to a degree during the active duty for training to such an extent that it can be diagnosed, then it's a chronic disease and it does qualify for incurrence in service. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything else? Because yes. We took some of your time here.
Final point, aggravation. Presumption of aggravation should also apply for the same reasons we discussed with the presumption of soundness, but also there's affirmative evidence in the form of the VA neurosurgeon's opinion, which would indicate the worsening of the condition during the time of active duty for service, which even if the presumption did not apply, would still require the VA to make a specific finding that the worsening was due to the natural progression of the disease. That was not in the board's record, or the decision, and they did not address that. And I believe we've already touched on the presumption of chronic diseases, which is very similar to the presumption of soundness, except that it states that the language of the statute makes it clear that it's for veterans who have active military service, it does not restrict that presumption to just situations where there's been, quote, active duty. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Monique Allen, representing the secretary, and with me at council table is Richard Daly, senior appellate attorney. The court should affirm the board decision in this case because appellant has not demonstrated that she's entitled to benefits or the presumptions which she claims they do not apply in this case. If we start first addressing appellant's contentions, there is, as the board stated, the medical evidence does not support a finding for service connection. We have the 2005 medical examination from a private examiner who stated that the tumor was slow growing. We have the 2007 VA private medical examination that indicates that the headaches that occurred most likely occurred, it began in April 1999, prior to appellant's active duty for training service, as well as appellant's and her husband's testimony at the hearing, where they both indicated that the headaches began as early as 1989. So clearly the evidence of record demonstrates that there was not an incurrence of the headaches or the meningioma symptoms during her active duty training period in June, July 1999. And would like to point out that that active duty period was in fact 3 5-day periods of service. It occurred June 14th through 18th, June 21st through 25th, and then again June 28th through July 2nd. So there were three separate periods of service, of active duty service.
Of 1999.
Of 1999, Your Honor. That's correct.
Well, Counselor, while I have your attention.
Yes, sir.
Let's turn and discuss a little bit 38 U.S.C. 1111.
Yes, sir.
And Congress limits the presumption of soundness only to periods of active duty. Is that your contention?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But the question, I guess, is doesn't it limit it to this concept of veteran, as Counselor was explaining his theory of active duty for training versus active duty and so forth. Doesn't it apply to a veteran? Isn't that the only qualification that's in 38 U.S.C. 1111?
Your Honor, that's not exactly the only qualification.
Okay.
In order to have this presumption of soundness to kick in or to begin or to apply or attach, the individual has to have been examined, accepted, and enrolled in service. And in this case, the appellant was not examined, accepted, or enrolled prior to her three separate periods of active duty training.
Okay. Is there a requirement that the appellant should have been examined, accepted, and enrolled before active duty for training?
Your Honors, we say that there's not. That's why this applies to veterans serving on active duty, where there is a requirement that there is an examination, an acceptance, and enrollment.
And how about the annual physicals? Do they play a part in here? Counselor was suggesting that there were annual physicals for a period of time.
Well, Your Honor, that's not in the record before the agency. We do have in the record that there were periodic examinations, the record recorded history, and they were not yearly. There was one in 87, 80, 91, and 96. However, they are not the same kind of examination that one would have when they're coming into the military, where there is a specific kind of examination to find out if the individual is ready, basically, for military service.
How do you know that?
Well, there's separate, just, Your Honor, reviewing the formats that the individual fills out or that are in the records, they're different and they are more detailed for an individual coming into the military.
And what differences specifically applies to this case?
Your Honor, in this case, the appellant did not have any type of examination prior to her three periods of active duty service. So there's nothing to base anything on to say that she was sound.
What about the statement that there's reference to form DD, I think it's DD forms or uniform forms or whatever it is, 93, in the VA doctor's report that he reviewed these?
Your Honor, I believe he was referring to the record of history that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Those were dated, as I mentioned, 87, 91, and 90. I believe it was 96. It may have been 98.
What was the date of his opinion?
This was November 2007, Your Honor.
Okay.
So this examiner did review the record before the agency. He had all of this evidence. He reviewed appellant's report of history and made his opinion based upon that, which ties into my next point, that the examination is indeed an adequate exam. The examiner...
Now, wait a minute. Let me go back. You were talking about the elements that are required for the presumption under Section 1111.
Yes, sir.
Do you dispute at all that Ms. Smith was a veteran?
Your Honor, Ms. Smith was a veteran for VA compensation purposes.
Well, it says veteran. That's the first element, veteran.
Yes, sir.
Well, the definition of veteran isn't that served in active duty for a period, in this case, at that time of 90 days.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And appellant did serve for 90 days mm-hmm. in 1982, so she is a veteran for that period of time.
Well, wait a minute. I left the service in 1980. I'm not a veteran?
Yes, Your Honor, you're a veteran, but if you're seeking compensation...
That's a different matter.
Okay.
We're just talking about the word veteran.
Now, yes,
do you believe that she's a veteran, Ms. Smith?
Ms. Smith is a veteran.
Right.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
For
what? Does it say in the statute that it's limited to service connection? What can you say?
No, sir, it does not.
So on what do you base that statement? There may be other reasons that...
Yes,
somebody's
sir.
Not entitled to the presumption, but
yes, sir. Okay.
Is this one of them?
No, sir. You're
okay,
correct.
So we all agree that the individual is a veteran. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay.
Counsel, does 38 CFR 3.307A add any clarity to the question regarding... the basis for applying an ACDUTRA period here? You're familiar with 3.307, right?
Yes, sir, I am. But I'm not...
The language there that discusses the date of separation will be the date of discharge or release from the period of service on which the claim is based?
Yes, Your Honor, that's referring to such service, and the 90-day period would be the such service that it's referring to. It is our contention that appellant does not have that requisite 90-day period because she served on those three separate five-day periods totaling 15 days, which would not equate to the 90 days that are required.
Is there any indication in the legislative history or the regulatory history that Congress intended to extend these presumptions to reserve duty?
No, Your Honor. In fact, it looks that it specifically indicates you have to serve 90 days.
My question is there any legislative or regulatory history? Because the brief did not touch on any regulatory history of this provision, and I'm curious if you're aware of any, since it wasn't raised in the brief, that indicated that Congress intended to extend these presumptions to reserve or did not intend, either way.
Your Honor, my review of the legislative history, of the congressional history, did not indicate that there was an intent to apply these presumptions to ACDUTRA service.
Counselor, I think this is where you were headed.
Yes, sir.
Take this court's precedent in Steffel and apply it to the opinion of November 27, 2007. Is the opinion adequate or isn't it, in your opinion?
Your Honor, we submit that this opinion is adequate. There's not a lot for the examiner to base his opinion on in the first place. There's not a lot of facts. Appellant indicated, as the examiner stated, that she suffered headaches as early as April 1999, and that's in the opinion. She then goes on Act Dutra for June and July 1999 for 3 5-day periods. Subsequent to that, 2 months later in September 1999, she is examined and diagnosed with left meningioma, which is removed in October 1999. Those are the basic facts of the case, and the examiner went through all of those facts, then provided an opinion stating that he believed that the headaches were a symptom of her meningioma. We, based upon the facts of this case and in light of Scuffle, we submit that this is an adequate opinion.
Thank you. Well, I do have another question that may or may not relate to the medical opinion, but is continuity of symptomatology under 38 CFR 3303 potentially applicable to the appellant's claim in here? Do you understand the question?
Yes, I do understand, you know, your question, Your Honor. I'm just wanting to filter through it for just a moment. I would say that that it was not in play here, as it was not. There's no evidence. It's our position that continuity of symptomatology is not in play because the evidence of record does not raise that would be an issue here. She was not on active duty or active duty for training prior to there's no reason to start looking at anything prior to her 1999 June-July period of service.
Well, isn't that the question, though? I mean, we have an 87 medical opinion that says headaches may have been related to the condition. According to counselor, we have other medical opinions that talk about the headaches. And I'm just curious as to whether or not that's part of the continuity of symptomatology analysis.
Well, Your Honor, there's no evidence. Appellant was not on active duty during those periods of time. There's no evidence that there would be any to service, so there would not be a reason for the board to have addressed any continuity of symptomatology at that time.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know where you get this, your contention that in order to be, if I understood your statement correctly, that in order to qualify as a period of active duty, the individual, for disability, I guess let me stop for a second, that an individual cannot be, receive disability benefits unless they've been on a period of active duty for 90 days. Did I understand you did I understand that to be your statement?
Your Honor, not necessarily. I'm sorry, I may not have been very clear. It depends on the type of service that's involved. For example, Act Dutra service, the 90 day is not required, but there would have to be some kind of incurrence or aggravation of a disease or disability during that period of time, and that period could be as short as one day.
Okay.
However, that's not the case in the case at hand.
Okay.
In closing, we would ask that the court would affirm the board's decision in this case. The evidence does not reveal that appellant's left meningioma was incurred or aggravated during her active duty service. And She is not entitled to the presumptions of service connection and soundness.
Counsel, before you close, yes, I have a few more questions.
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to put together this presumption of service connection and the presumption of soundness and the statutory language and the regulatory language. And as I understand it, Congress in the late 60s expanded the applicability of the statutory presumption of service connection to any veteran who served in active military, naval, or air service after December 31st of 1946.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was an expansion from the original language, which only applied to veterans who served during a period of war, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And then the Secretary's regulation, which is the regulation I referred to earlier, 3.307, I suppose could have said and used language, release from active duty, which would have been, at least from my perspective, more consistent with the statutory change to active duty. But instead, 3.307 didn't say release from active duty. Instead, it said it will be the date of discharge or release from a period of service on which the claim is based, which kind of suggests what the opposing counsel is arguing, and that is that there may have been other active duty periods contemplated by the Secretary. And I'm kind of hoping that you'll tell me I'm right or wrong, or give some indication that what the Secretary intended by that language in the regulation. Because it kind of muddles the water a bit from my standpoint.
Well, Your Honor, the regulation is based upon the statute, and the Secretary does not have the authority to expand the statute any further than it already applies. And the regulation was, in fact, it was enacted. We're looking at exposure to herbicides, former prisoners of war, chronic diseases, these kinds of things that while you may not have had the contemplation is a service member who may have come aboard and is a prisoner of war and may not have exceeded the 90-day period. He's captured within a couple of days. He can still, under this regulation, still be entitled to benefits. So I'm not sure if this is getting to your question or not.
Well, I think you've answered it, Counsel. And my question was basically, do you know why the regulation was written the way it was? And I think you're telling me you don't know the answer to that question, right?
Is that correct? I mean, is that correct with Judge Davis's characterization of your answer that you don't know?
No, Your Honor. My answer is basing it upon my review and reading and my review of the legislative history was more on lines of what I was
specifically ending. What part of the legislative history?
Which part
would
of it?
Which supports your position?
Your Honor, I don't have those.
Well, then why are you saying that it's based on your reading of the legislative history if you can't cite to something? Is it cited in your brief?
It's not cited in my brief, Your Honor.
And that's okay,
yes,
we'll take that for what it's worth. Then.
Yes, sir.
One other question, Counsel. I understand the supplemental pleading that you filed in response to the court's order for supplemental briefing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Indicates that there were no medical examinations conducted for the active trip period.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And upon what do you base that?
Review of the claims file and the RBA. Which
is there a requirement that such examinations occur?
No, Your Honor, it would not. And this would be a prime example of a case where it would not make sense for an individual who's serving back-to-back service 2 days, a weekend apart, to have to come in and have another examination each future period of time. Again, the Secretary submits that the presumption of soundness and service connection do not apply in this case, and appellant is not entitled to benefits. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I believe that the statement in the supplemental record of proceedings that the government filed is a little overbroad, in that it says there was no medical examination conducted prior to the veteran's entry into active duty for training this particular period. There were multiple examinations.
Excuse me, what period are we talking about?
The June, July 1999.
Okay.
There were multiple examinations conducted over the years. Now, if they're talking about in close proximity, I would have to say there is nothing in the record that indicates it, meaning within the month or the 6 months prior, but there were multiple examinations over the years.
You're talking about the annual physical examination.
Plus her, first she entered, when she entered into service in 1981 in active duty, right, there was an exam conducted. And then when she first entered into guard duty, there would have been an exam, and then we have for the annual physicals. So I think that would be an overbroad statement to say that there were none conducted. I think that this raises to me a hypothetical question. You know, can the government, by not conducting an entrance exam, defeat the presumption of soundness and other presumptions simply by not conducting it? And I think that's what the Fed Circuit case I cited, Jensen, goes to. If the government is in the best position to determine the soundness of the veteran prior to entrance into any period of service, and if it fails to do so, then the burden is on it to show that there was an exception to soundness. And they can do this. It's not absolute. They can show by clear and unmistakable evidence that there was that the veteran was not in sound condition.
Well, I might accept, you know, that's a compelling argument. If it seems to me there was a requirement that the government conduct this examination with each period of service. In other words, the duties of and responsibilities and reasons for conducting the examinations for military people is governed by Title 10. In other words, you know, they have their own reasons for conducting these examinations. It's Title 38, in other words, whether or not you're entitled to veterans' benefits, that accords the presumption that would flow from these examinations. So can you address your proposition that the government cannot defeat by inaction the application of the presumption, these two presumptions, by not providing an examination if there's no requirement to do so?
Well, I think that doesn't change the Fed Circuit Jensen case, because Jensen says they're in the position to do it. They could require it. If they don't, they basically do it, I guess, at their peril. Because the way the regulations and statutes are written, they accept the veteran goes and does what he or she is asked to do. So I think they're in the best position and would have, should do it if they don't. Now, I will say this, that I know the court probably didn't invite me here just to make a reasons and bases argument, but certainly none of this was addressed at the board level, and it certainly at the very minimum should be remanded, and the actual consideration made, and a consideration made of what the requirements are, and an analysis of the presumption of soundness in connection with those requirements.
Counselor, Judge Lance actually raised this question earlier, and I wanted to follow up on it on a point. And let me do so by offering a hypothetical. Let's say we have a veteran who served on active duty for a year. And in this case, we'll make it a Marine, since the senior judge on this panel is a former Marine. And so he's on active duty for a year and then got off of active duty and was out of active duty for the next 10 years, and then joined the reserves. and took on an act dutra assignment for, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks. Is your position that the presumption of soundness based on the 11-year earlier medical examination when the Marine was on active duty would apply to the Marine now in the reserves?
Well, I will candidly tell you that there are members of the Veterans Advocate Bar that disagree on that that particular point, and some say yes. I think that my position would be that that there is an exam required when you do enter into the reserves at the initial inception, and that would be a pertinent exam. And then I think the purpose of the annual physical, because the veteran is not actively in service, obviously, as he would be if he or she were full-time. So the annual physical asks the same questions. The form's basically the same. You know, do you suffer from XYZ? And then they do an examination. So it doesn't appear to be materially different. The actual examination is conducted on an annual basis. So I think that is I think that qualifies for what we're talking about. Now, I think we're all talking about things that are not necessarily specifically covered, you know, in the statutes. And there has to be an interpretation. But I would assert that no matter what the interpretation, no matter which entrance exam we look at in this case, you don't have any notation of a tumor or a situation like that. Certainly there are headaches, but just as if a person could have an undiagnosed case of lung cancer, and they might indicate that they had coughs when they were inducted, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't prove service connection for lung cancer that later manifests just because they had some symptom that might be or might not be. So I would argue that no matter which exam we do focus on that are here, none of them rebut or note this condition. And also, if there was none, if we're going to say that there is no exam, then I think we have to look at Jensen and say, well, if there was no exam, there the government was in a position to conduct an exam, and if it fails to do so, they can't penalize the veteran, because the veteran's obviously not in a position to dictate whether the exam is conducted or not.
But because none of the exams rebut the position or the condition, your position is that the presumption of soundness should apply.
Exactly, yes. Certainly, well, the board would have to consider whether, you know, whether there was clear and mistakable evidence. You know, it'd have to adjudicate that issue as to whether it was rebutted or not. Here, the board never mentions the presumption. And I think that's critical, that it seems the entire board's opinion seems to really turn on the fact they found it to be a pre-existing disorder. They seem to, you know, that seems to be, once they reach the conclusion it's pre-existing, they seem to end the inquiry at that point. And I think that's not the end of the inquiry, because you have the other issues, aggravation, you know, whether the presumption of soundness should apply, and those things are not even mentioned. So at the very least, the board should address those issues. Thank you.
Sorry. I have another question here. This goes to your statement that at least there are some people who believe, and I think you're arguing, that any examination can qualify as an examination to trigger the presumptions.
Correct.
I'm looking at the basic entitlement statute, which is 1131. I don't know if you have it in front of you, and if you don't, that's fine. You don't have to.
I do have it somewhere.
Okay. As I read that statute, and I'll read it to make sure that I've got it in my mind straight. For disability resulting from personal injury suffered or disease contracted in the line of duty, or for aggravation of a pre-existing injury suffered or disease contracted in the line of duty in the active, military, naval, or air service, during other than a period of war, the United States will pay to any veteran thus disabled and who was discharged or released under conditions other than dishonorable from the period of service in which said injury or disease was incurred. So it seems to me that that would say that in order for these presumptions to kick in, because we're only permitting compensation during the period, you know, before the individual was discharged or separated, that examinations that occurred before separation, that period of separation, or that were not conducted for purposes of entry into that period of service would not count. Does that, I'm not sure if that's a question or a statement, but if you understand it, can you comment on it?
Was that 1131?
Yes, 1131. And take your time if you have it there and want to read it.
Well, you know, in the abstract, meaning, you know, if we're talking just statutory construction, it's a very difficult question. But in this particular case, I can tell you that because of the VA neurosurgeon's opinion, that we do have a case where the veteran did contract the disease in the active military service. So now, as that relates to presumption of soundness, that's a puzzle. I mean, that's a different...
And your contention is that they contracted during the 1999 period of service?
Yes, and I don't mean to try to suggest that it didn't pre-exist, but I think it's a chronic disease. Obviously, there could be symptomatology prior to that, but it obviously manifested to a degree to which it could be diagnosed during the June and July 1999 active duty for service period. So that would be, you know, our position on that. Section 3.303B, the chronic disease portion.
Sorry, does anybody have a question based on that? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. The case is submitted, and the court will greet counsel.
All rise.
Who knows what